welcome to the Elephant Cast. Today we'll be talking to David D. David, welcome to the Elephant.
Thank you.
Thank you. So let's get started, David. And there has been a lot of talk about the economic slowdown given the political situation in Kenya. I wanted to begin by asking you, does Kenya have an economy in the sense of a market-driven supply and demand where firms compete on a level playing field?
The important characterization of the economy in the manner in which you seek is to look at it as a dual economy. If you look at the structure of employment, it's a good thing to give you an indicator, because an economy is predominantly reflects of where people work and what they do.
Mm-hmm.
You have a labor force of about 16 million people now. Of those, about 12 million work in what you call non-farm, micro and small enterprises, which sometimes people call informal sector. Another 3 or so million who are also largely people working for themselves in their own little farm enterprises. So that gives you almost probably 90% of the labor force.
Yes.
So only about 10% works in what you might call formal establishments. What you call the corporate or formal establishment economy is a capital intensive economy. And the other one you could also call it a labor intensive economy. The labor intensive economy, informal micro enterprise, whatever you want to call it, where most Kenyans work, is very competitive. It's a real economy with a lot of competition. Free market. It's got free entry and exit. They are not regulated, so they're very competitive.
Okay, so you've talked about the market arrangement at, for lack of a better word, the informal sector. That, and I totally agree with you, in that there are sections with which it's almost like a perfect market. So if you want to start a kiosk, you have a little money, you can go and start a, next to a person who has a kiosk and sell exactly the same things, and just somehow things will regulate themselves. What about the macro level, so corporation level, when we're talking about the other side of the economy now? Would you say that that's also a free market economy in the same way as it is at the informal sector?
It varies. Like in many other economies, you tend to have fewer businesses. Where we a bit different, we have a huge problem of conflict of interest, because this is a country where we have absolutely no rules about people being straddling government and business. Because of that, people straddle business, and it's accepted. It's become the norm, and there's a history to it, so that it becomes very difficult for government to be an impartial referee in a market where the most powerful people in government are also the most powerful people in business.
In business. Mm-hmm.
So you have what economists in that industry call regulatory capture. It can progress, and we are seeing some sectors where this has progressed to what you might actually call state capture, so that the whole state then begins to serve the private as a means
to accumulate
personal wealth.
So then, for me, then this leads to the next question. If that is the goal, let's say for the people who want to accumulate personal wealth, wouldn't it not be better to create a fully functional business? Because it shows that the more competition firms have, the more innovative that they can be, and therefore the more profits that they can make.
A competitive market is good for consumers. It's not good for business owners. Business owners will always prefer monopolies. What happens is that the people in government colluding with other people in the market to, mm-hmm. to undermine competition. That means they are able to make policies which yes. are favorable to their own businesses. Let me dichotomize. I talked about a labor-intensive economy and a capital-intensive economy. This corporatized economy is capital-intensive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many people in government have an interest in that capital-intensive economy. Now, if you are an owner of capital,
mm-hmm.
then your interest is return, is to maximize the return on capital. Now, if you are making impartial economic policy for a country,
mm-hmm.
then you would be wanting to maximize employment, yeah, and labor productivity,
yes,
in the employment largely. So what you find, and you can see that very clearly, is that a lot of policy and public investments, mm-hmm. economic investments, are geared to increasing the returns of existing capital, because that's mm-hmm. what they own, as opposed to maximizing employment. Okay?
Mm.
So you have a huge prejudice. You ask yourself, for instance, why is it that when you hear private sector, the people you see with voice, so-called
yes.
captains of industry, who only employ just under 2 million people,
mm.
why don't we see the voice of the economy, which employs 12 million people, which absorbs 500,000 people a year, as opposed to this corporate economy, which only absorbs 50,000 people a year? So you can see now how it biases policy, in that they're looking for, that's why they keep talking about cost of doing business, efficiency,
mm-hmm.
all sorts of things, because that increases the bottom line for existing businesses, as opposed to creating new businesses,
mm.
which will employ more people.
And you find what you end up with is probably one big player in each sector. So
yeah.
year after year, all you're able
dominant.
To produce is one dominant.
One dominant, one or two. Most, yeah.
And even in the new and upcoming sectors, it's not long before you realize, okay, there's only one dominant, because it's just consolidation and capture that happens.
Yeah, these people control the levers.
The levers,
of,
yeah.
of. They mm. can use entry deterrents, they can use all sorts of things. And so they undermine the competitiveness of
okay.
the economy, because they are interested in making, in maximizing the return on their capital, as opposed to maximizing the employment in the whole economy. So what does that mean? That means that they cannot absorb
these masses of people. That need
so these
work.
Masses of people by default
move into the informal,
move into
what we
the
call
informal,
the informal
economy.
That makes sense. That really makes sense. So when people talk about Kenya is able to produce more workers in the informal sector, it's just an outcome of the design of these two dichotomies that you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay, the follow-on question is this then. If that is how it is, how do we then get the corporate business entangled away from the state? Because unless we can get those two separate, then we will just continue how we are in terms of more people being absorbed in terms of labor in the informal sector.
I think that's a political battle that's playing out. You find that a corporate sector, that corporate economy, which has aligned in its interest with the current Jubilee administration, because Jubilee administration, they have the same interest. The Kenyatta family are the biggest sort of corporate oligarchy in this country. This is people who have acquired their businesses through state patronage and all sorts of stuff. So the rest of them aligned mm-hmm. with them because they think their interest, they're
mm-hmm.
aligned. But they conflate their interests with the interests of the country. So as they have done that,
mm-hmm.
and they have then suffocated that sector
mm-hmm.
in terms of its ability to compete and create jobs and that kind of
and
thing.
Innovate. Just
and innovate.
Innovate.
It's very profitable for
mm-hmm.
them, but it's actually not doing anything else.
For the consumer,
for the economy. It's just profitable for them. Okay, so that's what they're protecting. In the meantime, we are churning out 700,000-800,000 young people into the labor force a year who they cannot absorb. So these people out there are alienated from that sector. So even as they are speaking and calling themselves a private sector, people are wondering, so what does this private sector do for me except sell me overpriced goods? So what it creates is something a Kenyan economist many years ago called Peter Hopcraft called an aristocracy of labor. It employs a small percentage of the population, which is privileged. Mm-hmm. It's a bubble which is predominantly in Nairobi. And it's sort of a very navel-gazing bubble, which is whose interests are now aligned with this corporate entity, because this corporate entity is basically a rent-seeking sort of thing. It's earning sort of economic monopoly rent. It's able to share these rents with its workforce. And then you've got the masses out there doing their own thing, doing their juakali thing. So it's now become a political cleavage.
So then, is the hope in the informal sector?
What you want to do is to break up this stranglehold, and you want to begin by putting a Chinese wall between government and business. So that government makes impartial policy.
You talked about the need for a Chinese wall between government and business, so that government can be government and a fair referee, and business can be business. Could you elaborate a little bit more?
That's political. You just have to say we do not want politicians with huge business interests, so that when they go in government, so you cannot know where their private interests end and public begins. Mm. I think people have to become educated and realize that these oligarchs, even if they are your ethnic chiefs, your interest, economic interest, cannot be aligned with somebody who wants to be in government so that they can protect or further their private business interests.
Okay.
And many countries have rules for making sure that even if somebody is elected who has business interests, they put pressure on them to separate those interests, that put assets in blind trust and all sorts of things.
Okay, so let's move on to elections and economic slowdowns. So there have been this talk in the media, or in the mainstream media at least, with economic slowdown, and every 5 years there's an election, every 5 years there's an economic slowdown. It's become more like the booms and busts that you hear about in the West. Going forward, what needs to be done so that elections don't impact the economy as significantly as it does now?
You need to make elections non-events, like Tanzania has, like Ghana is doing. So that's the thing. And for elections to be non-events, they have to be free, fair, and credible.
Mm.
But as long as elections are contentious, they are such high-octane, high-stake events.
Mm.
But why are they?
Mm.
They are because the spoils of power are such that people are willing to fight tooth and nail to keep it.
And for us, what makes it even more difficult, it's not just about power. It's not people who just want to be in power and to be in control. This is mixed with people who want to protect the power to advance personal wealth.
That's what I mean. During elections in Kenya, there is a convergence of people who are who are protecting power, but also because of the political debate, there is now the unleashing of all the grievances and the sense of people who also want to express their frustrations with the state. These are fairly fundamental sort of frictions in society that crystallize around elections. That election process becomes the outlet for a lot of these frictions that we refuse to deal with. We have tried to, we thought that the whole process of the new constitution and changing that and dealing with the historical grievances, but obviously what we've seen is, particularly since 2013, is the capture of the state by a regime which is even more antithetical to those values than probably we ever had before. So, and also more aligned, as we say, it has managed to consolidate these profiteer interests together. So now you do actually have sort of fairly well-defined
battleground
for between these interests. If you go back, we have had, I think, under what we call the Second Liberation, two major political milestones. The first milestone was the multi-party, to allow multi-party. But after multi-party, it was fairly obvious that you could not keep the old constitutional political sort of order. The next milestone became a battle for fundamental political reforms.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long time, but those reforms culminated in the new constitution. It's been clear since then, certainly to the people like myself who see this, seen this reform sort of process long term, that the perhaps the next big hurdle, we don't know whether there'll be another one, but the next big hurdle, and we hope it's the last one for a democratic transition, is free and fair elections. Free and fair election, if you followed our campaign, we said it was an end in itself. It was not even about whether we win or lose. Mm. We didn't want free and fair election so that we could lose in it. If we had lost in a free and fair election, we would have felt we have achieved. So for us, the electoral process is a fundamental reform battleground. It is not just about this election. I think that is the one thing that we want to ensure, because it solves all these problems you're talking about. It solves the political business cycle too. You're asking, what's the end game of this? The end game of this is actually to restructure the economy. We begin to talk very fundamentally about what kind of economy works for us. The big picture is, as you said, we've pursued political liberation. But the reason why political liberation is so difficult is because of the economic interest that people are protecting. So we now have to get Kenyans to understand that you have to fight for economic liberation as well. So the whole conversation we've been having is about how do we also liberate the economy from this capture. So what we're dealing with is businesses which we identify as culpable in that state capture and whose interests are the primary, the interests that have aligned themselves with this state capture. We've talked about, if you look at some of these products, let's talk about soap and consumer, this consumer product. These products are very easy to make. If you look at dairy, why should milk leave Trans-Nzoia, get put in trucks, okay, taken all the way to Kiambu for processing, and then it's taken all the way back and sold in Bungoma? In the processing carrying sort of costs, why don't the people of Trans-Nzoia sell their milk to the people of Bungoma next door? They're the same people. You're talking about boycott, but what is the alternative? What alternatives do we want? We want people to do those things in their communities. So what we see is that we now bring the two together and talk about our economic interest and our political interest. Because you see, in a democracy, because these people are using the economic interest and using these sort of political arguments to undermine democracy. But the voter and the consumer is the same person.
Yes, because people don't vote just because they like to go and vote. They are hoping that this will lead to some shape or form, a better life for them, whatever that is.
So what we're saying is these people are making their political vote not count. But you have another vote. Yeah? It's called the consumer vote. You can use that as well. You have undermined you're undermining our democracy so that our vote doesn't count. We queue in the sun for hours and then you come there in bombers and your numbers don't add up. You're really making nonsense of the ballot. But we also have a vote called a shilling. So you can use the vote. So this is continuation of politics. You want to shut that door? You're going to use this other vote called the shilling. My parents' generation, they regale us with stories of growing up during Mau Mau. And they suffered. I mean, just how they sort of sacrificed. The way that's when they were sort of young. And sort of, I think my mother was like a school student, you know, going into high school. And I sort of have, I mean, a lot of family. So this is sort of fairly sort of relatable conversation in much of Central Kenya. And they suffered, they talk about it, but I have never had anybody regret that they sacrificed. That's why I say, no, you know, maybe we should have lived a good life and under colonialism for those 7-8 years. Like my father-in-law spent 10 years in detention. He spent more time than Kenyatta. And I also have relatives who spent six. I think I have a great uncle who spent 6 years. So you meet, all these people are still alive, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they have no regrets. I think the idea of trading short-term material sort of comfort for justice and freedom, I think that's I don't know any society which considers that a sort of a fair trade-off.
This is important because we talked about the clamor or the struggle for multi-party democracy and then the struggle for new constitution.
The question you want to ask, if I can throw it back to you, is it important? I mean, if let's say, okay, you're saying at what cost? So what is the cost of accepting sham elections? That's the question you want to ask.
Mm.
Do we accept sham elections? Do we go the Uganda route or the Rwanda route? Is that the way we want to go? And if you say that's not the way we want to go, then we don't have a choice. We don't ask how long it takes or what it's going to cost. I think we do it. What we are very clear is that we're going to do it using legitimate political means. There is enough civic ammunition to use. One of the fundamental principles of political freedom is the right to dissent. Okay, that is why one of the most protected, some of the most protected rights are freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. Okay, because those are really your tools of civic expression. If you cannot assemble and if you cannot speak, then that is what leads people to take up arms. Now, regimes which do not allow people dissent are called totalitarian states, you know, like North Korea. So, one of the things you must not do is succumb to a regime which says it wants to be a dictator, and then you give up your political space. The purpose of continuing with assembly and protest and all the things allowed in the Constitution by Article 37, it is to assert that right. If you do not assert it, it will be taken away. That's what they want. You know, 2-3 years down the road, it becomes unacceptable. They could even actually amend the Constitution. We've been there before. So we fought very hard for that right. And you can see it's a contested. They want to contest it. It's about extinguishing that right. That's why if you go to any sort of mature democracy, there are all sorts of little groups protesting, demonstrating. You go to Hyde Park, you've got little people. Mm. My favorite, I lived in Rome for a while. There was not a single day without a group picketing a particular public office. That's the way democracy.
So why do ours have violence?
Because there are people who, with a very totalitarian instinct, they were able to do this from independence to the early 90s. When I was in college, demonstration was illegal. We got arrested and locked up. I spent many days in Central and in Yale House. Yeah, so for people like us, we're not going to give it up.
So actually this violence, your views that it's being perpetrated by the state.
It's by the state.
Not the rowdy people that come to city and break shops.
They are sponsored by the state. If you look, the purpose is to make the demonstration unruly. And then you then sort of delegitimize. Mm. So it's all a delegitimization strategy. We've been there before. We've seen these before. These are old tricks.
Well, thank you. I think that's fairly comprehensive. I appreciate you making the time. Thank you so much.